late 18th century thing. May or may not be something that will go on tape, I don't know. I picked a couple of fairy tales. See what they sounded like. They're not usual ones. I mean, one of them. I picked Captain Murderer, do you remember that? It is not a usual fairy tale. It's the one that was told to Dickens by his nurse. Did you ever hear that one? I don't know if it's something you can read on for kids or anything. I don't know. See what it sounds like, anyway.
I've actually seen it recently. I had to go to toilets to get the Lego set. And it's actually cassettes.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Well, this, let's see, I have to get fairly close, man. I was thinking of a nursery rhyme first, if I can remember it, all right? There was an old woman had three sons, Jerry and James and John. Jerry was hung and James was drowned. John was lost and never was found. And that was the end of the woman's three sons, Jerry and James and John. Or another one, do you know, two pigeons? I had two pigeons, bright and gay. They flew from me the other day. What was the reason they did go? I cannot tell, for I do not know. Here's a fairy tale. But it's a Norwegian fairy tale. It's called Buttercup. Once on a time, there was an old wife who sat and baked. Now, you must know that this old wife had a little son who was so plump and fat and so fond of good things that they called him Buttercup. She had a dog, too, whose name was Goldtooth. And as she was baking, all at once Goldtooth began to bark. "Run out, Buttercup, there's a dear," said the old wife, "and see what Goldtooth is barking at." So the boy ran out and came back crying out, "Oh, heaven help us, here comes a great big witch with her head under her arm and a bag at her back." "Jump under the kneading trough and hide yourself," said his mother. So in came the old hag. "Good day," said she. "God bless you," said Buttercup's mother. "Isn't your Buttercup at home today?" asked the hag. "No, that he isn't. He's out in the wood with his father, shooting ptarmigan." "Plague take it," said the hag, "for I had such a nice little silver knife I wanted to give him." "Pip, pip, here I am," said Buttercup, under the kneading trough, and out he came. "I'm so old and stiff in the back," said the hag. "You must creep into the bag and fetch it out for yourself." But when Buttercup was well into the bag, the hag threw it over her back and strode off. And when they had gone a good bit of the way, the old hag got tired and asked, "How far is it off to Snoring?" "Half a mile," answered Buttercup. So the hag put down the sack on the road and went aside by herself into the wood and lay down to sleep. Meantime, Buttercup set to work and cut a hole in the sack with his knife. Then he crept out and put a great root of a fir tree into the sack and ran home to his mother. When the hag got home and saw that what there was in the sack, you may fancy she was in a fine rage. Next day the old wife sat and baked again, and her dog began to bark just as he did the day before. "Run out, Buttercup, my boy," said she, "and see what Goldtooth is barking at." "Well, I never," cried Buttercup as soon as he got out. "If there isn't that ugly old beast coming back again with her head under her arm and a great sack at her back." "Under the kneading trough with you and hide," said his mother. "Good day," said the hag. "Is your Buttercup at home?" "I'm sorry to say he isn't," said his mother. "He's out in the wood with his father, shooting ptarmigan." "What a bore," said the hag. "Here I have a beautiful little silver spoon I want to give him." "Pip, pip, here I am," said Buttercup, and crept out. "I'm so stiff in the back," said the old witch. "You must creep into the sack and fetch it out for yourself." So when Buttercup was well into the sack, the hag swung it over her shoulders and set off home as fast as her legs would carry her. But when they'd gone a good bit, she grew weary and asked, "How far is it to Snoring?" "Half a mile," answered Buttercup. So the hag set down the sack and went inside into the wood to sleep a bit. But while she slept, Buttercup made a hole in the sack and got out and put a great stone into it. Now when the old witch got home, she made a great fire on the hearth and put a big pot on it and got everything ready to boil Buttercup. But when she took the sack and thought she was going to turn out Buttercup into the pot, down plumped the stone and made a hole in the bottom of the pot so that the water ran out and quenched the fire. Then the old hag was in a dreadful rage and said, "If he makes himself ever so heavy next time, he shan't take me in again." The third day everything went just as it had gone twice before. Goldtooth began to bark, and Buttercup's mother said to him, "Do run out and see what our dog is barking at." So out he went, but he soon came back crying out, "Heaven save us, here comes the old hag again with her head under her arm and a sack at her back." "Jump out of the kneading trough and hide," said his mother. "Good day," said the hag as she came in at the door. "Is your Buttercup at home today?" "You're very kind to ask after him," said his mother. "But he's out in the wood with his father, shooting ptarmigan." "What a bore now," said the old hag. "Here I have such a beautiful little silver fork for him." "Pip, pip, here I am," said Buttercup as he came out from under the kneading trough. "I'm so stiff in the back," said the hag. "You must creep into the sack and fetch it out for yourself." But when Buttercup was well inside the sack, the old hag swung it across her shoulders and set off as fast as she could. This time she did not turn aside to sleep by the way, but went straight home with Buttercup in the sack, and when she reached her house, it was Sunday. So the old hag said to her daughter, "Now you must take Buttercup and kill him and boil him nicely till I come back, for I'm off to church to bid my guests to dinner." So when all in the house were gone to church, the daughter was to take Buttercup and kill him, but then she didn't know how to set about it at all. "Stop a bit," said Buttercup. "I'll soon show you how to do it. Just lay your head on the chopping block, and you'll soon see." So the poor silly thing laid her head down, and Buttercup took an axe and chopped her head off just as if she'd been a chicken. Then he laid her head into the bed and popped her body into the pot and boiled it so nicely, and when he'd done that, he climbed up on the roof and dragged up with him the fir tree root and the stone and put the one over the door and the other at the top of the chimney. So when the household came back from church, saw the head on the bed, they thought it was the daughter who lay there asleep. Then they thought they'd just taste the broth. "Goodbye, my troth, Buttercup broth," said the old hag. "Goodbye, my troth, daughter broth," said Buttercup down the chimney, but no one heeded him. So the old hag's husband, who was every bit as bad as she, took the spoon to have a taste. "Goodbye, my troth, Buttercup broth." "Goodbye, my troth, daughter broth," said Buttercup down the chimney pipe. Then they all began to wonder who it could be that chattered so and ran out to see. But when they came out at the door, Buttercup threw down on them the fir tree root and the stone and broke all their heads to bits. After that, he took all the gold and silver that lay in the house and went home to his mother and became a rich man. This is a fairy tale, but it's not a fairy tale that ever appeared in print for children, although it was a fairy tale told to a child. It was told to Charles Dickens when he was a little boy, before he was 6 years old, by his nursemaid. And he tells about it in this story. "The first diabolical character who intruded himself on my peaceful youth was a certain Captain Murderer. This wretch must have been an offshoot of the Bluebeard family, but I had no suspicion of the consanguinity in those times. His warning name should seem to have wakened no general prejudice against him, for he was admitted to the best society and possessed immense wealth. Captain Murderer's mission was matrimony and the gratification of a cannibal appetite with tender brides. On his marriage morning, he always caused both sides of the way to church to be planted with curious flowers, and when his bride said, 'Dear Captain Murderer, I never saw flowers like these before. What are they called?' he answered, 'They are called garnish, for house lamb,' and laughed at his ferocious practical joke in a horrid manner, disquieting the minds of the noble bridal party with a very sharp show of teeth, then displayed for the first time. He made love in a coach and six and married in a coach and 12, and all his horses were milk-white horses with one red spot on the back, which he caused to be hidden by the harness. For the spot would come there, though every horse was milk-white when Captain Murderer brought him. And the spot was young bride's blood. When Captain Murderer had made an end of feasting and revelry and had dismissed the noble guests and was alone with his wife on the day month after their marriage, it was his whimsical custom to produce a golden rolling pin and a silver pie-board. Now, there was this special feature in the captain's courtships that he always asked if the young lady could make pie-crust. And if she couldn't, by nature or education, she was taught. Well, when the bride saw Captain Murderer produce the golden rolling pin and silver pie-board, she remembered this and turned up her lace silk sleeves to make a pie. The captain brought out a silver pie dish of immense capacity, and the captain brought out flour and butter and eggs and all things needful except the inside of the pie. Of materials for the staple of the pie itself, the captain brought out none. Then said the lovely bride, "Dear Captain Murderer, what pie is this to be?" He replied, "A meat pie." Then said the lovely bride, "Dear Captain Murderer, I see no meat." The captain humorously retorted, "Look in the glass." She looked in the glass, but still she saw no meat, and then the captain roared with laughter, and suddenly frowning and drawing his sword, bade her roll out the crust. So she rolled out the crust, dropping large tears upon it all the time, because he was so cross. And when she had lined the dish with crust, and had cut the crust all ready to fit the top, the captain called out, "I see the meat in the glass." And the bride looked up at the glass, just in time to see the captain cutting her head off. And he chopped her in pieces, and peppered her, and salted her, and put her in the pie, and sent it to the baker's, and ate it all, and picked the bones. Captain Murderer went on in this way, prospering exceedingly, until he came to choose a bride from two twin sisters, and at first he didn't know which to choose. For though one was fair and the other dark, they were both equally beautiful. But the fair twin loved him, and the dark twin hated him, so he chose the fair one. The dark twin would have prevented the marriage if she could, but she couldn't. However, on the night before it, much suspecting Captain Murderer, she stole out and climbed his garden wall and looked in at his window through a chink in the shutter and saw him having his teeth filed sharp. Next day she listened all day and heard him make his joke about the house lamb. And that day month he had the paste rolled out and cut the fair twin's head off and chopped her in pieces and peppered her and salted her and put her in the pie and sent it to the baker's and ate it all and picked the bones. Now, the dark twin had had her suspicions much increased by the filing of the captain's teeth and again by the house lamb joke. Putting all things together, when he gave out that her sister was dead, she divined the truth and determined to be revenged. So she went up to Captain Murderer's house and knocked at the knocker and pulled at the bell, and when the captain came to the door, said, "Dear Captain Murderer, marry me next, for I always loved you and was jealous of my sister." The captain took it as a compliment and made a polite answer, and the marriage was quickly arranged. On the night before it, the bride again climbed to his window and again saw him having his teeth filed sharp. At this sight she laughed such a terrible laugh at the chink in the shutter that the captain's blood curdled, and he said, "I hope nothing has disagreed with me." At that she laughed again in a still more terrible laugh, and the shutter was opened and search made, but she was nimbly gone and there was no one. Next day they went to church in a coach and 12 and were married. And that day month she rolled the pie crust out, and Captain Murderer cut her head off and chopped her in pieces and peppered her and salted her and put her in the pie and sent it to the baker's and ate it all and picked the bones. But before she began to roll out the paste, she had taken a deadly poison of a most awful character, distilled from toad's eyes and spider's knees. And Captain Murderer had hardly picked her last bone when he began to swell and to turn blue and to be all over spots and to scream. And he went on swelling and turning bluer and being more all over spots and screaming until he reached from floor to ceiling and from wall to wall. And then, at 1 o'clock in the morning, he blew up with a loud explosion. At the sound of it, all the milk-white horses in the stables broke their halters and went mad, and they galloped over everybody in Captain Murderer's house, beginning with the family blacksmith who had filed his teeth, until the whole were dead, and then they galloped away. Hundreds of times did I hear this legend of Captain Murderer in my early youth, and added hundreds of times there was a mental compulsion upon me in bed to peep in at his window as the dark twin peeped, and to revisit his horrible house and look at him in his blue and spotty and screaming stage as he reached from floor to ceiling and from wall to wall. The young woman who brought me acquainted with Captain Murderer had a fiendish enjoyment of my terrors and used to begin, I remember, as a sort of introductory overture by clawing the air with both hands and uttering a long, low, hollow groan. So acutely did I suffer from this ceremony in combination with this infernal captain that I sometimes used to plead I thought I was hardly strong enough and old enough to hear the story again just yet. But she never spared me one word of it, and indeed commended the awful chalice to my lips as the only preservative known to science against the black cat, a weird and glaring-eyed supernatural Tom who was reputed to prowl about the world by night sucking the breath of infancy, and who was endowed with a special thirst, as I was given to understand, from mine. This female bard, may she have been repaid my debt of obligation to her in the matter of nightmares and perspirations, reappears in my memory as the daughter of a shipwright. Her name was Mercy, though she had none on me. I thought I'd try reading The Three Bears, because I never thought of reading it, but as I opened a book, it came up. This is the original, printed, English printed version by Robert Southey. The story of the three bears. Once upon a time, there were three bears who lived together in a house of their own in a wood. One of them was a little, small, wee bear, and one was a middle-sized bear, and the other was a great, huge bear. They had each a pot for their porridge, a little pot for the little, small, wee bear, and a middle-sized pot for the middle bear, and a great pot for the great, huge bear. And they had each a chair to sit in, a little chair for the little, small, wee bear, and a middle-sized chair for the middle bear, and a great chair for the great, huge bear. And they had each a bed to sleep in, a little bed for the little, small, wee bear, and a middle-sized bed for the middle bear, and a great bed for the great, huge bear. One day, after they had made the porridge for their breakfast and poured it into their porridge pots, they walked out into the wood while the porridge was cooling, that they might not burn their mouths by beginning too soon to eat it. And while they were walking, a little old woman came to the house. She could not have been a good, honest old woman, for first she looked in at the window, and then she peeped in at the keyhole, and seeing nobody in the house, she lifted the latch. The door was not fastened because the bears were good bears who did nobody any harm and never suspected that anybody would harm them. So the little old woman opened the door and went in, and well pleased she was when she saw the porridge on the table. If she'd been a good little old woman, she would have waited till the bears came home, and then perhaps they would have asked her to breakfast, for they were good bears, a little rough or so, as the manner of bears is, but for all that, very good-natured and hospitable. But she was an imprudent, bad old woman, and set about helping herself. So first she tasted the porridge of the great, huge bear, and that was too hot for her, and she said a bad word about that. And then she tasted the porridge of the middle bear, and that was too cold for her, and she said a bad word about that, too. And then she went to the porridge of the little, small, wee bear and tasted that, and that was neither too hot nor too cold, but just right, and she liked it so well that she ate it all up. But the naughty old woman said a bad word about the little porridge pot because it did not hold enough for her. Then the little old woman sat down in the chair of the great, huge bear, and that was too hard for her. And then she sat down in the chair of the middle bear, and that was too soft for her. And then she sat down in the chair of the little, small, wee bear, and that was neither too hard nor too soft, but just right. So she seated herself in it, and there she sat till the bottom of the chair came out, and down came she plump upon the ground. And the naughty old woman said a wicked word about that, too. Then the little old woman went upstairs into the bedchamber in which the three bears slept, and first she lay down upon the bed of the great, huge bear, but that was too high at the head for her. Next she lay down upon the bed of the middle bear, and that was too high at the foot for her. And then she lay down upon the bed of the little, small, wee bear. That was neither too high at the head nor at the foot, but just right. So she covered herself up comfortably and lay there till she fell fast asleep. By this time, the three bears thought their porridge would be cool enough, so they came home to breakfast. Now the little old woman had left the spoon of the great, huge bear standing in his porridge. "Somebody has been at my porridge," said the great, huge bear in his great, rough, gruff voice. And when the middle bear looked at his, he saw that the spoon was standing in it, too. They were wooden spoons. If they had been silver ones, the naughty old woman would have put them in her pocket. "Somebody has been at my porridge," said the middle bear in his middle voice. Then the little, small, wee bear looked at his, and there was the spoon in the porridge pot, but the porridge was all gone. "Somebody has been at my porridge and has eaten it all up," said the little, small, wee bear in his little, small, wee voice. Upon this, the three bears, seeing that someone had entered their house and eaten up the little, small, wee bear's breakfast, began to look about them. Now, the little old woman had not put the hard cushion straight when she rose from the chair of the great, huge bear. "Somebody has been sitting in my chair," said the great, huge bear in his great, rough, gruff voice. And the little old woman had squatted down the soft cushion of the middle bear. "Somebody has been sitting in my chair," said the middle bear in his middle voice. And you know what the little old woman had done to the third chair. "Somebody has been sitting in my chair and has sat the bottom out of it," said the little small wee bear in his little small wee voice. Then the three bears thought it necessary that they should make further search, so they went upstairs into their bedchamber. Now the little old woman had pulled the pillow of the great huge bear out of its place. "Somebody has been lying in my bed," said the great huge bear in his great rough gruff voice. And the little old woman had pulled the bolster of the middle bear out of its place. "Somebody has been lying in my bed," said the middle bear in his middle voice. And when the little small wee bear came to look at his bed, there was the bolster in its place, and the pillow in its place upon the bolster, and upon the pillow was the little old woman's ugly, dirty head, which was not in its place, for she had no business there.
"Somebody has been lying in my bed, and here she is," said the little small wee bear in his little small wee voice.
The little old woman had heard in her sleep the great rough, gruff voice of the great huge bear, but she was so fast asleep that it was no more to her than the roaring of wind or the rumbling of thunder. And she had heard the middle voice of the middle bear, but it was only as if she had heard someone speaking in a dream. But when she heard the little, small, wee voice of the little, small, wee bear, it was so sharp and so shrill that it awakened her at once. Up she started, and when she saw the three bears on one side of the bed, she tumbled herself out at the other and ran to the window. Now the window was open, because the bears, like good, tidy bears as they were, always opened their bedchamber window when they got up in the morning. Out the little old woman jumped, and whether she broke her neck in the fall, or ran into the wood and was lost there, or found her way out of the wood and was taken up by the constable and sent to the House of Correction for a vagrant as she was, I cannot tell. But the three bears never saw anything more of her. This is a story written by a woman who was 4 feet 8½ inches tall. Her name was Mariah Edgeworth. And the title of the story is The Purple Jar. Rosamond, a little girl about 7 years old, was walking with her mother in the streets of London. As she passed along, she looked in at the windows of several shops and saw a great variety of different sorts of things of which she did not know the use or even the names. She wished to stop to look at them, but there was a great number of people in the streets, and a great many carts, carriages, and wheelbarrows, and she was afraid to let go her mother's hand. "Oh, mother, how happy I should be," she said, as she passed a toy shop, "if I had all these pretty things." "What, all? Do you wish for them all, Rosamond?" "Yes, mother, all." As she spoke, they came to a milliner's shop, the windows of which were decorated with ribbons and lace and festoons of artificial flowers. "Oh, mother, what beautiful roses! Won't you buy some of them?" "No, my dear." "Why?" "Because I don't want them, my dear." They went a little further and came to another shop which caught Rosamond's eye. It was a jeweler's shop, and in it were a great many pretty baubles ranged in drawers behind glass. "Mother, will you buy some of these?" "Which of them, Rosamond?" "Which? I don't know which. Any of them will do, for they're all pretty." "Yes, they are all pretty. But of what use would they be to me?" "Use? Oh, I'm sure you could find some use or other for them if you'd only buy them first." "But I would rather find out the use first." "Well, then, mother, there are buckles. You know that buckles are useful things, very useful things." "I have a pair of buckles. I don't want another pair," said her mother, and walked on. Rosamond was very sorry that her mother wanted nothing. Presently, however, they came to a shop which appeared to her far more beautiful than the rest. It was a druggist's shop, but she did not know that. "Oh, mother, oh," cried she, pulling her mother's hand. "Look, look, blue, green, red, yellow, and purple. Mother, what beautiful things. Won't you buy some of these?" Still her mother answered as before, "Of what use would they be to me, Rosamond?" "You might put flowers in them, mother, and they would look so pretty on the chimney-piece. I wish I had one of them." "You have a flower-pot," said her mother, "and that is not a flower-pot." "But I could use it for a flower-pot, mother, you know." "Perhaps," said her mother, "if you were to see it nearer, if you were to examine it, you might be disappointed." "No, indeed, I'm sure I should not. I should like it exceedingly." Rosamond kept her head turned to look at the purple vase till she could see it no longer. "Then, mother," said she after a pause, "perhaps you have no money." "Yes, I have. Dear me, if I had money, I would buy roses and boxes and buckles and purple flower pots and everything." Rosamond was obliged to pause in the midst of her speech. "Oh, mother, would you stop a minute for me? I've got a stone in my shoe. It hurts me very much." "How comes there to be a stone in your shoe?" "Because of this great hole, mother. It comes in there. My shoes are quite worn out. I wish you would be so very good as to give me another pair." "Nay, Rosamond, but I have not money enough to buy shoes and flower pots and buckles and boxes and everything." Rosamond thought that was a great pity. But now her foot, which had been hurt by the stone, began to give her so much pain that she was obliged to hop every other step, and she could think of nothing else. They came to a shoemaker's shop soon afterwards. There, Mother. There are shoes. There are little shoes that would just fit me, and you know shoes would really be of use to me. Yes, so they would, Rosamond. Come in. She followed her mother into the shop. Mr. Soule, the shoemaker, had a great many customers, and his shop was full, so they were obliged to wait. Well, Rosamond, said her mother, you don't think this shop so pretty as the rest? No, not nearly. It is black and dark, and there are nothing but shoes all around, and besides, there's a very disagreeable smell. That smell is the smell of new leather. Is it? Oh, said Rosamond, looking round. There's a pair of little shoes. They'll just fit me, I'm sure. Perhaps they might, but you cannot be sure till you've tried them on, any more than you can be very sure that you should like the purple vase exceedingly, till you have examined it more attentively. Why, I don't know about the shoes, certainly, till I have tried, but, Mother, I am quite sure that I should like the flower pot. Well, which would you rather have, that jar or a pair of shoes? I will buy either for you. Dear Mother, thank you. But if you could buy both. No, not both. Then the jar, if you please. But I should tell you that in that case I shall not give you another pair of shoes this month. This month? That's a very long time indeed. You can't think how these hurt me. I believe I'd better have the new shoes. Yet that purple flower pot. Oh, indeed, Mother, these shoes are not so very, very bad. I think I might wear them a little longer, and the month will soon be over. I can make them last till the end of the month, can't I? Don't you think so, Mother? Nay, my dear, I want you to think for yourself. You will have time enough to consider the matter whilst I speak to Mr. Soule about my clogs. Mr. Soule was by this time at leisure, and whilst her mother was speaking to him, Rosamond stood in profound meditation with one shoe on and the other in her hand. Well, my dear, what have you decided? Mother, yes, I believe I have. If you please, I should like to have the flower pot. That is, if you won't think me very silly, Mother. Why, as to that, I can't promise you, Rosamond. But when you have to judge for yourself, you should choose what will make you happy. And then it would not signify who thought you silly. Then, Mother, if that's all, I'm sure the flower pot would make me happy, said she, putting on her old shoe again. So I choose the flower pot. Very well, you shall have it. Clasp your shoe and come home. Rosamond clasped her shoe and ran after her mother. It was not long before the shoe came down at the heel, and many times she was obliged to stop to take the stones out of it. She often limped with pain. But still the thoughts of the purple flower pot prevailed, and she persisted in her choice. When they came to the shop with a large window, Rosamond felt much pleasure upon hearing her mother desire the servant who was with them to buy the purple jar and bring it home. He had other commissions, so he did not return with them. Rosamond, as soon as she got in, ran to gather all her own flowers, which she kept in a corner of her mother's garden. "I'm afraid they'll be dead before the flower pot comes, Rosamond," said her mother to her, as she came in with the flowers in her lap. "No, indeed, Mother, it will come home very soon, I dare say. I shall be very happy putting them into the purple flower pot." "I hope so, my dear." The servant was much longer returning home than Rosamond had expected, but at length he came and brought with him the long-wished-for jar. The moment it was set down upon the table, Rosamond ran up to it with an exclamation of joy. "I may have it now, Mother?" "Yes, my dear, it is yours." Rosamond poured the flowers from her lap upon the carpet and seized the purple flower pot. "Oh, dear Mother," cried she as soon as she had taken off the top, "but there's something dark in it which smells very disagreeably. What is it? I didn't want this black stuff." "Nor I, my dear. But what shall I do with it, Mother?" "That I cannot tell. It will be of no use to me, Mother." "That I cannot tell. But I must pour it out and fill the flower pot with water." "As you please, my dear. Will you lend me a bowl to pour it into, Mother?" "That was more than I promised you, my dear, but I will lend you a bowl." The bowl was produced, and Rosamond proceeded to empty the purple vase. But she experienced much surprise and disappointment on finding, when it was entirely empty, that it was no longer a purple vase. It was a plain white glass jar, which had appeared to have that beautiful color merely from the liquor with which it had been filled. Little Rosamond burst into tears. "Why should you cry, my dear?" said her mother. "It will be of as much use to you now as ever for a flower pot." "But it won't look so pretty on the chimney piece, I'm sure. If I'd known that it was not really purple, I should not have wished to have it so much." "But didn't I tell you that you had not examined it, and that perhaps you would be disappointed?" "And so I am disappointed, indeed. I wish I'd believed you at once. The shoes, for I shall not be able to walk all this month. Even walking home that little way hurt." "Mother, I will give you the flower pot back again, and that purple stuff and all, if you'll only give me the shoes. No, Rosamond, you must abide by your own choice, and now the best thing you can possibly do is to bear your disappointment with good humor. I will bear it as well as I can, said Rosamond, wiping her eyes. She began slowly and sorrowfully to fill the vase with flowers. But Rosamond's disappointment did not end here. Many were the difficulties and distresses into which her imprudent choice brought her before the end of the month. Every day her shoes grew worse and worse, till at last she could neither run, dance,
jump, nor walk in them.
Rosamond was called to see anything. She was detained, pulling her shoes up at the heels, and was sure to be too late. Going out to walk, she could not take
Rosamond with her, for Rosamond had no soles to her shoes.
On the very last day of the month,
it happened that her father proposed to take her with her brother.
She had long wished to see.
She was very happy, but when she was quite ready, had her hat and gloves
downstairs
on,
to her brother and father.
Downstairs to her brother and father, who were waiting for her at the hall door. The shoe got off. She put it on in a great hurry, but as she was going across the hall, her father turned round.
Slipshod.
Why are you walking slipshod? No one must walk slipshod with me. Why, Rosamond?
Her shoes with disgust. Was neat.
I thought that you
go.
Go. I cannot take you with me. Rosamond colored and retired. Oh, mother, said she, as she took off her hat.
That I had chosen the shoes.
They would have been of so much more use to me than that jar. However, I'm sure...
No, not quite
sure. But I hope I shall be wiser another time.